Good morning and welcome to Second Court of Appeals. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Mark Wallen. To my right is Justice Lloyd Birdwell. I'm Bonnie Sells, the Chief of the Court. It's my understanding that the parties have checked in and everyone's ready. We have two cases to be heard this morning, two appeals, two arguments, and they are related. And so we probably will not take a break between the two arguments, even if we have time. We'll just go right into the second argument. I know that there's going to be different people arguing the second one, but we'll let you know that. Before we begin, if the clerk would please call the first case.
The court will now call estate of William Alvin Moncrief Jr., deceased. May it please the court, Mr. Russell Barton will argue for the appellants. Mr. William Barsh will argue for the appellee.
Mr. Barton.
May it please the court, the injunction order should be reversed because under the court's three-step analysis in the MFP case, the container agreements form and are unchallenged. The container agreements are binding on appellees. The arbitration clauses delegate arbitrability to the arbitrators, and there is no specific challenge to the arbitration clauses, including the delegation of arbitrability clause. I would like to briefly discuss some of the facts and their similarities to the court's opinion in the MFP case. The broad arbitration clauses here are the same as in MFP, and an example of that is included under tab one of the handout. In the trial court, the appellees, joined by the arbitration respondents, raised the capacity undue influence dispute to challenge three categories of documents signed by Texas. First, the amendments to Texas Management Trust naming Dick and Marshall as trustees. And this is the same challenge that's addressed by footnote 5 of the MFP opinion. Second, Texas signing of a Fourth Amendment to the SBR agreement, naming Dick and Marshall and Tom as managers of SBR. And that's similar to the dispute in MFP regarding the Fourth and Fifth Amendments to the MFP agreement. Thirdly, Texas exercise of a power of substitution, which caused the membership interest and Oil and Gas Master to automatically revert to the management trust. For the court's reference and convenience, tabs 2 and 3 of the handout are timelines of the facts concerning SBR and Oil and Gas Master and the pending arbitrations. The SBR agreement is governed by Colorado law. The Oil and Gas Master Agreement is governed by Texas law. But under the court's three-step analysis, arbitration is required under both Colorado and Texas law. Under the BRM construction,
what is the significance of the court, the trial court's granting the motion to strike the original South Depot Ranch? What impact does that have?
It doesn't. And the reason being is that the appellees cannot raise the same challenge in the trial court that's at issue in the arbitration. Under the BRM construction case and the city and county of Denver cases, Colorado courts apply an analysis that's similar to the court's three-step analysis. And under that analysis, the capacity undue influence dispute must be arbitrated. Step one, the container agreements.
And the Colorado courts actually held the capacity in going to be an arbitrable issue, or are you just saying that that's how, if you apply the Colorado analysis, that's how we should do that?
The latter. Colorado courts do follow Morgan Stanley, which says that a capacity challenge to a container agreement is for the court. But it's in that context. Arbitrators are competent to consider capacity challenges to other documents. The LLC company agreements signed in 2010 are the container agreements. Appellees raise no formation challenge to the container agreements, and the arbitration clauses have never been deleted or amended. As in MFP, the arbitration clauses are expressly made binding on successor members and managers and their legal representatives. And I think it's significant that these are governing documents of the companies. Under Colorado and Texas statutes, successor members are bound by the terms of a company agreement. And under Colorado and Texas statutes, the companies themselves are bound. And that makes it binding on the managers, because a manager managed LLC can only act through its managers. The arbitration clauses are binding on appellees because they are, or they claim to be, successor managers or legal representatives of successor members of the entities. And they're also binding under direct benefits estoppel. Excuse me. Appellees claim the rights and benefits under the container agreements as legal representatives of the members and as managers. Appellee's reliance on Jody James doesn't apply here for the same reason discussed in footnote 3 of the MFP opinion. Jody James dealt with a stranger to the contract to whom direct benefits estoppel did not apply. It did not deal with a person bound by the express terms of the agreement and by statute. Step 2 of the analysis. The arbitration clauses are the same here as in MFP, and by incorporating the AAA rules, the clauses delegate arbitrability under both Colorado and Texas law. And that ends the analysis in step 2. Whether the capacity undue influence dispute has any merit or not is not the issue. It's just that it's been delegated to be heard by the arbitrator.
Since we're dealing with an issue with regard to an individual capacity, two questions. First, is there any distinction in the law that's coming out of probate court between determination of testamentary capacity and simply the capacity of contract? And if there is a distinction, how should that be influenced the matter under the provision?
Yeah, I don't think that it raises a significant difference, and the reason being that in the arbitration context, a capacity challenge has to be to the container agreement. And the Supreme Court, this court, and MFP recognize that arbitrators are competent to decide capacity challenges to other documents. And the fact that the probate court may have jurisdiction, that's where Merrill Lynch comes into play. Arbitrability is an issue, is at issue in the arbitrations. AAA says that the arbitrators are going to decide that. And what Merrill Lynch says is when you have an issue pending in both arbitration and litigation, the arbitration takes priority.
Your second question, TL versus Cook Children's Medical Center, we spent quite a bit of time discussing the doctrine of parent patriarchy with regard to the child's fault. But all of the case law with regard to that goes back to the ability of the team to work out for subjects, including the mental health. So why, given the strength of policy, state should be protecting the interests of those who are alleged to be mentally incompetent. Why is it something that should be in the public's arbitration?
Well, I think clearly the public policy of Texas is in favor of arbitration. And if the container agreements are binding, if they're not challenged for capacity formation reasons like they're not here, then tax clearly intended for these kinds of disputes to be arbitrated. The clauses are about as broad as they can. They delegate arbitrability. And that really kind of seals it right there. He intended for arbitrability questions to be decided by the arbitrator.
And more specifically, he intended for his capacity in making any amendments to these agreements to be subject to arbitration.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I, you know, because these amendments are, you know, all of these documents, they were all text. Appointed successor members, managers, partners, you know, that would take effect upon his death or incapacity. And so he clearly recognized that there could be disputes between successors as to whether he had capacity to do this or do that. And under these clauses, he intended those to be arbitrated.
Okay, so what happens if we end up applying him in these cases? It goes to arbitration and the arbitrator determines he was not competent to make the changes that the old one made.
Then, you know, depending on what other issues may be.
So the state only gets involved in terms of affirming the determination of a private arbitrator with regard to the capacity of an individual.
I think that's correct. Under step three, appellees do not challenge the existence of the arbitration clauses or the formation of the container agreements. And as the court held in MFP, in the arbitration context, the capacity of undue influence challenge is a challenge to the enforceability of an existing contract that gets decided by the arbitrator. Even as to the challenge to the Fourth Amendment to the SBR agreement, just like in MFP, that is a challenge to the enforceability of the agreement as a whole. And even if it could be considered that their challenge to the management trust amendments constitutes a challenge to the validity of the arbitration clauses under the separability doctrine, that issue has been delegated to the arbitrators under step two. The order staying and enjoining the arbitration should be reversed and vacated and remanded with instructions to stay the litigation of the capacity of the
And please support Bill Boyce on behalf of the applicants, Gloria Moncrief, Tom Moncrief, and Gary Allen. I'd like to start with Justice Wallach's question. What is the significance of the court's order, especially granting the motion to strike the interventions? And the answer is, it is significant, and I'll explain why. I'm not here to re-argue Moncrief 1. Not surprisingly, we respectfully disagree with the majority's ruling. We agree with the dissent, but that ship has sailed. It's in a different court now. But I do want to stress that I think that Moncrief 1 is not controlling here for at least two reasons, and in part they dovetail with what Justice Birdwell has raised. Number one, to your point, Justice Wallach, under the probate court's orders, and in this case the February order, there is no fight in probate court over a company agreement, the so-called container agreement, because the probate orders carve that out and set that aside. The second distinguishing issue is that this appeal, these orders arise from a probate court with exclusive jurisdiction over the estate and ancillary jurisdiction over the trusts, and that drives a different analysis, and I'll unpack these a little bit, but I do want to highlight some key points at the outset.
The only so has the question of incapacity or duress been raised in the arbitration independent of what's going on in the project?
No, it is not. And I'll answer that in two ways. Number one, I would direct the court to the arbitration demands. They appear at Defendant's Exhibit 69 and Defendant's Exhibit 70, and the court will see how they can marshal frame the arbitration demands. A second answer to your question, Justice Wallach, is that any contention that somehow the appellees have asked the AAA to decide this issue with respect to management trust is incorrect. It's inconsistent with the record. What the court will see in the attachments to our motions to stay arbitration are multiple letters to the American Arbitration Association saying, don't decide this, stand down. This is an important decision. In no way, shape, or form have the appellees asked or acceded to having the AAA decide this capacity issue with respect to the management trust. But I also want to make sure I stress these points. There is no arbitration clause in the management trust. There is no arbitration clause in the will. And if the contention on the other side is that text intended amendments to the trust or the will to be arbitrated, then that is flatly inconsistent with the fact that text chose not to have an arbitration clause in the management trust and chose not to have an arbitration clause in the will.
So does the temporary injunction then apply to the Moncrief oil and gas question?
Well, let me answer your question by pointing to the specific parts of the February order that I would highlight for the court. These are highlighted in the oral argument exhibits that we handed up before argument today. And there's two key parts here. So I'm looking at the February order. And if the court looks at the bottom of page one or about halfway down page two, what the court sees is that the probate court carved out any disputes supposedly pertaining to the company agreements or the so-called container agreements. The court did that with respect to the oil and gas master dispute in paragraph one, where it grants Dick and Marshall's motion to strike the intervention. It wasn't our motion. We tried to intervene, and they asked for the intervention to be stricken, and the probate court granted that. So it struck Gloria, Gary, and Tom in any capacities relating to the 2010 trust. The 2010 trust is the one at issue in oil and gas master. effectively it struck the 2010 trust from the scope of this order. And in so doing, it took off the table any dispute about the merits of what Dick and Marshall say they want to arbitrate with respect to oil and gas master. That being a fight about whether or not the substitution transaction can go forward to try to get back things that were sold and conveyed to the trust. So that's an answer for oil and gas master. For South Beaver Ranch, I would also direct the court to the same portion, bottom of page one, carrying over to page two, where the court granted the motion to strike the intervention of Gloria as co-trustee of the Deborah Beggs Moncrief Family Trust, and the same for Tom, struck the intervention of Tom as co-trustees of Deborah's trust. That took away any dispute about the quote-unquote company agreement, the quote-unquote container agreement with respect to South Beaver Ranch. So what's going on here? I think the distinction between this case and Moncrief 1, among others, is the fact that this order is narrowly tailored to try to isolate an issue, isolate solely the issue of capacity with respect to making amendments to the management trust and who are the co-trustees of the management trust. And why did the court do that? Well, the court explained its rationale. This court will turn to page 6 of the handout, paragraph 10. The court explained exactly why it was doing what it was doing. And I'll quote a portion of this paragraph 10. Richard and Marshall are attempting to force alleged trustees and or alleged beneficiaries of the management trust to arbitrate who controls the management trust, even though the management trust does not contain any arbitration provisions. By invoking the arbitration provision in the contract, the company agreements, which the management trust signed with third parties. So if you put paragraph 10 together with the granting of the motion to strike the intervention that's reflected in pages 1 and 2, what you see is the probate court is carving out disputes over the company agreements, carving out the so-called container agreements, and isolating the focus of this order solely on the management trust. Now, why is that important that the court did that? This goes to the point regarding exclusive probate jurisdiction over the estate and ancillary probate jurisdiction over the trust. The probate court is protecting its jurisdiction to address the will and the estate, its jurisdiction to address the management trust. And those are intertwined because under Article 3 of the will, the March 30th will, Article 3 leaves all of the estate to the management trust. And so these components are inextricably intertwined, and the probate court is protecting its jurisdiction to address who's in charge of the management trust. And that flows from
the Moncrief, Moncrief 1, the previous case.
Yes.
If this court has ordered it, that those claims to be, those issues to be arbitrated, the probate court says, no, they can't arbitrate, what are they supposed to do?
Well, I guess I will answer your question by disagreeing about the scope or the reach of Moncrief 1. And so I don't, if the court is perceiving a conflict there between...
I'm asking, is there a conflict? If there is or if there isn't, tell me why.
There is not a conflict, and maybe a way to answer that is to focus on a portion of Moncrief 1. So I'm looking at page 163 of the opinion in Moncrief 1, where this is the last paragraph before section 2, standard or review, where the court makes the point that the claims raised in the trial court are the same dispute that appellants submitted to arbitration. So that's a key distinction because as we've just gone through in terms of what got carved out, the claims submitted to arbitration are different in this case, in this appeal, in the probate court. The claims in arbitration are different from the claim that the probate court has carved out.
I'm trying to understand In probate court, though, they're saying that these amendments should not be allowed because text didn't have the capacity or was improperly influenced, right? But that's it.
Amendments to the management trust.
Right.
Yes.
But the issue is capacity to do things at a given point in time.
I think you're identifying one of the seams in the analysis here. And I put it this way because according to Dick and Marshall, the capacity or undue influence dispute is this great big amorphous blob that covers any dispute pertaining to capacity for any purpose for any document. And I don't think it can work that way. It can't work that way specifically with respect to probate court jurisdiction. Somebody has to be, let me put it this way. I think that the probate court's jurisdiction, its exclusive jurisdiction over the will, its ancillary jurisdiction over the trust need to be protected because the administration of the estate is ongoing. It's not a static situation. Somebody needs to be in charge or able to make decisions or able to take actions on behalf of the estate and the management trust to which all of the estate poured over. And so
are the time frames in terms of the incapacity or duress the same in probate court and in the 96 case?
They are overlapping is probably the way to put it, but here's the way that it makes most sense to me. Let's focus on March 30th. March 30th was the date of the will that Dick and Marshall...
I'm going to get to will versus trust.
Okay.
I'm just talking about time frame. Let's talk about time frames on the trust and time frames on the 96. Are they the same?
They are overlapping is the best way I know how to answer that because there were multiple amendments to the trust over a period of time. Going back at least to October of 2020, multiple amendments to the management trust, and then they kind of converge, the will and the management trust amendments converge on March 30, 2021, which was the date of the last testament of Tex Moncrief that was submitted for probate, and it was also the date of the 38th amendment of the management trust. So. I hope I'm answering your question. I think there is overlap, but I think that the point here is that it is erroneous to conceive of the undue capacity slash lack of capacity undue influence dispute as this big blob that covers every possible disagreement or dispute about capacity. There are different capacity determinations for different documents, and as far as the intertwining of the will and the estate goes, that's something that the probate court has to decide. The probate court, the exclusive probate jurisdiction excludes other courts, and it excludes a body such as an arbitral body making those determinations. And I go back to this practical point, which is the will leaves everything to the management trust. The management trust is an ongoing entity. It's got activities. It has to pay taxes. It has to do all sorts of things. Somebody has to be in control of the management trust in order for it to act, and somebody has to decide who is in control of the management trust, and that somebody is the probate court. So I think if you take a step back, this is what the probate court is attempting to accomplish in these orders by narrowly construing the dispute, by carving away fights over the company agreements, taking those out because it granted the motions to strike the intervention, and it focuses solely and exclusively in the February order on incapacity or undue influence dispute with respect to the management trust because that's what it has to decide. That's what an arbitrator cannot decide. So I hope that
just out of curiosity, counsel, why does the probate court have ancillary jurisdiction over the management trust but didn't exercise ancillary jurisdiction over the matter that was before us in the first case, it was in '96. I know, and this is off the top of my head, I remember Judge King yanking a personal injury case out of my court, literally, by himself. He's over, he parked next to me in the garage. I was like, one day I was just kind of like, can you do that? And yes, of course you can. So that would suggest that probate courts are given extra jurisdiction with regard to anything that has to do with anything with regard to probate. Why wasn't that done with regard to Judge Gallagher in '96, the matter before?
Well, I have some familiarity in which what I call reach out and grab jurisdiction, which is a strong form of jurisdiction. But the answer to your question, Justice Burwell, is why is it brought into this case, into this, why in this appeal was the fight over the management trust brought into this case? It's because Dick and Marshall filed a declaratory judgment in this case, in the probate case, saying that the probate court has to decide this issue being who are the rightful trustees of the management trust. And then,
I guess the reason I'm asking the question is because just as I was discussing with Reverend the Doctrine of Parent Patriarchy, that would also, the reach out and grab jurisdiction, would also seem to be a legislative indication that matters of capacity would be something that should be determined by the probate court.
And therefore,
the courts, and not subject to arbitrability.
I'm agreeing with you, and I think that your parents patriae discussion and exclusive probate court jurisdiction dovetail in that respect. But to complete my answer, I would direct the court to page 70 of the clerk's record in the Moncrief 3 appeal, the 00058 appeal, which is the original petition for declaratory judgment that Dick and Marshall filed to say, we are the co-trustees of the management trust, and nobody else is. So the answer to your question is that didn't happen in the prior case in the '96, but it got brought into the probate court at the request of Dick and Marshall, and then, having brought it in, having had everything consolidated, then Dick and Marshall do a 180, and suddenly they say, capacity or undue influence with respect to the management trust now somehow needs to be arbitrated. And they do that even though they say that, and I'm reading, paragraph 23 of the declaratory judgment. This is Dick and Marshall's pleading. Gloria Moncrief's wrongful claim that she is a trustee under revoked amendments to the management trust must be resolved by the court. The probate court.
That was before you filed your second and third amended counterclaims, bringing in various intervening parties, which had these other contracts, which had arbitration provisions, right?
That was before, and then subsequently in the February order, those intervening parties were all struck. So the court, the best way I can think of to articulate it is that the probate court carved off the so-called container agreement disputes, carved off the company agreement disputes, and what's left? What's left is what Dick and Marshall told the probate court that the court must decide. And so I think you can look at it in either of these ways, which is what does the order accomplish, and why does the order accomplish that? And both of those lead to the same conclusion, which is this case is in a different posture and in a different court from Moncrief 1. And because of that, it's not just a matter of saying, this has to be arbitrated, see Moncrief 1. I'll take a further step back. I think the fact that we're having an oral argument today, the fact that we're having separate oral arguments for separate entities is an important reflection of the fact that this arbitrability fight needs to happen on an entity-by-entity basis, a court-by-court basis, and a dispute-by-dispute basis. And I think that's exactly what the court has postured this to do by setting up in the way that it has. And so global references to say, well, that dispute got arbitrated, so this one has to be too, just doesn't cut it. And if there are any additional questions, I'll try to answer them.
There aren't various disputes interrelated by virtue of, well, if so-and-so is a trustee in the management trust, then it's going to affect this case and this case and this case, so they're all interrelated there, I think.
Well, there may be some relationship between cases, but I also don't want to lose, I see my time is completely done, finish my answer. I also don't want to lose sight of this question, which is, or this observation, which is, we, this case, and one we're going to argue immediately after it, is not a question of whether or not certain claims do or do not go to arbitration. All that is on the table right now is a question of who decides a threshold issue about who has authority to act on behalf of the management trust by initiating arbitration or paying taxes or paying a bill or giving somebody a sum of money, whatever it is. And so because we're at the threshold inquiry here, Justice Wallach, I think what is going on here is the probate court's attempt to create an orderly resolution of the threshold issue. And once that's done, once we know who the co-trustees of the management trust are, then everything else can be addressed in due order, because we know who has authority to act on behalf of the management trust, whether they have authority to institute an arbitration, and so forth. I hope that's an answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice Wallach, you're exactly right. They filed the pleading in the trial court raising the SBR and oil and gas master issue. And it invoked the arbitration clauses. So we then filed the arbitration. We did not deal with 180. They're the ones that filed the pleading that raised the issues regarding those companies.
Which goes back to the question I asked you originally, is what effect does the trial court's dismissal at your request of the intervening parties who had the arbitration agreements have on what we're talking about today?
Yeah, and I do not think that it does. Our position is not that the appellees must be compelled to arbitrate. They're already in the arbitrations as representatives for those parties.
So which goes back to the question I think I asked opposing counsel, which is the, are the claims of undue influence and mental incapacity currently in the arbitration proceeding?
Yes.
Raised by who?
They did.
Okay.
Their objection to arbitrability. Counsel admits this is an arbitrability fight. The basis of the arbitrability fight is the capacity undue influence dispute.
And that's been raised in the arbitration in front of the arbitrator.
That's right. And the record shows that AAA has, in response to the letters back and forth, has said the parties can submit their arbitrability issues or jurisdictional issues to the arbitrators. And so the arbitrators are going to decide.
How many arbitrations are contemplated, and therefore how many decisions by how many arbitrators as to whether or not has had capacity or was under the influence are contemplated by your argument? We're now doing two appeals. We've done one previous. Different agreements have different arbitration disputes. They all come down to whether or not there was a capacity and or undue influence. But arguably, each one of those disputes could be sent to a different arbitrator, in which case you could come up with different determinations by different arbitrators about his mental capacity and or whether he was unduly influenced. So what is a matter of public policy? Why are we contemplating allowing the agreement of parties by arbitration to make potentially conflicting determination?
Well, and, you know, AAA may consolidate all of them. I can't answer.
They don't have to, though.
I can't answer.
They don't have to. That's why I raised the issue of, as council mentioned, you know, grab back kind of thing. It is for me, who's making the decision and is it only a single decision?
Yeah, and I understand that, Your Honor. I can't answer the question about how many times they're going to raise the capacity undue influence dispute as to different things. They're the ones.
Every time they disagree with y'all's position is how many times they're going to raise it. And so how many arbitrators are going to do that? And is the arbitration, the first arbitration determination, going to be effectively raised judicata on a collateral estoppel to anything subsequent?
The fact of the matter is that based on their pleadings, their positions, it invokes the arbitration clauses for these different entities. And those have to be enforced. And they delegate arbitrability. He says this is an arbitrability fight. These clauses delegate arbitrability to the arbitrators. As the court held in MP Gulf, a rule that requires arbitrators to determine arbitrability only after a court has already determined arbitrability has no effect at all. It's not the law. I see my time's up.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we thank you for your argument today. Case number 02-23058CB has been submitted. And now we'll take up the next case. Would the clerk please call?